This is a case of a Cinderella story gone horribly wrong. In this case, there won't be any glass slipper. There won't be any handsome prince. The defendant doesn't have to be home by midnight. And there won't be any happy ending.
The date is April 24th, 2019, and Danny Porter, district attorney for Gwinnett County in Gwinnett County, Georgia, is speaking passionately to the seated jurors in front of him. It's his opening statement in a case he's been working on for about 5 years. He's telling the jury about a horrific crime involving a 10-year-old girl and how the girl's evil stepmother starved her to death and then tried to get rid of her body. Seated alone at the defense table, a notepad in front of her, is 36-year-old Tiffany Moss. She's who Danny Porter is referring to as the evil stepmother in his opening statements. Tiffany is listening to him as he speaks, and she appears to be taking notes. She listens as he tells the jury that not only is Tiffany responsible for the death of her stepdaughter, Imani Moss, but that it wasn't even the first time she had been arrested for abusing her. 3 years prior to Imani's death, Tiffany had been arrested and charged with first-degree child cruelty, but she eventually reached a plea deal that was signed off on by the Georgia Division of Family and Children's Services, or DFACS, that gave her just 5 years probation. It was reportedly part of Georgia's First Offender Program, which allows first-time offenders charged with certain crimes to plead guilty, and after their time is served, in this case, probation, the conviction is in a sense erased, and the charge is then sealed. After the deal was made, just 6 months later, Imani was returned to the home she shared with her father, stepmother, and half-siblings. But she wouldn't survive past her 11th birthday. Earlier, I told you that Tiffany was seated by herself at the defense table, which isn't something you see too often in a trial such as this one, where the stakes are incredibly high and the punishment on the table is the death penalty. But Tiffany is seated alone because she has decided to exercise her Sixth Amendment right, the right to represent herself in her criminal proceedings. Before we get started, I want to warn you that today's case does contain some testimony that may be triggers for people. The crime does involve the death of a 10-year-old child after all. I decided to cover the case, however, because I think there are valuable lessons to be learned about the way in which this case was handled, particularly by an organization designed to protect children. There are also some interesting legal issues in this case as well that I think are important to note. So with all that said, this is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, Episode 74. Five and a half years earlier, at 3:43 a.m. on Saturday, November 2nd, 2013, 30-year-old Iman Moss called 911. He told the dispatcher that he was suicidal, but what responding officers would soon find out was that Iman was harboring a devastating secret about his 10-year-old daughter. This is Detective Michael Poppy, a patrol officer with the Gwinnett County Police Department. He was one of the first officers to arrive at the apartment complex on Veranda Chase Drive in Lawrenceville.
Basically, the call that came out was, it came out as a suicide call. It didn't have much information in it. The call came in from Iman Moss, and it was talking about that there was possibly, they didn't know if it was a suicide threat or if there was somebody dead. It was confusion in the call when it was dispatched.
When you arrived on scene, were you one of the first responding officers to get there?
I was.
What did you observe when you arrived there at Veranda Chase?
When I arrived on scene, another officer had just pulled up prior to me, and he was out of his car speaking with Iman Moss about the call that had come in. The part that alerted me, though, was as we were en route to the call, the dispatcher was updating the call, and the call went from possible suicide to possibly having a dead body to possibly the body being a 10-year-old girl who may have drank some chemical. This was all updated in the call as we were en route. So when we arrived on scene, Officer Poche immediately made contact with Iman to try to figure out exactly what was going on.
Detective Poppy, who wasn't exactly sure what the call was at the time, decided to immediately ask Iman if there was, in fact, a 10-year-old girl on the premises who was in need of help. Iman pointed to a silver garbage can on the other side of the parking lot from where they were standing. He said his daughter had drank some chemicals and that she was dead. He said he didn't know what to do, and so he put her body in the garbage can and burned it. Detective Poppy ran over to the garbage can and looked inside. Sure enough, there was the body of 10-year-old Imani Moss. Detective Poppy immediately yelled at the other officer to detain Iman and to put him in handcuffs. By this time, additional officers were arriving on the scene. Yellow crime scene tape was put up, and they did a safety sweep of Iman's apartment to make sure there was no one else in there who needed help. Detective Poppy noted that there were two cribs inside the apartment, but no one else was inside. He went back downstairs and asked Iman who lived in the apartment with him. Iman told him that his wife, Tiffany, and their two younger children had just left prior to the police arriving. He said that Tiffany had taken the kids to her mom's house, which was nearby. When Detective Poppy arrived at Tiffany's mom's house, he spoke with Tiffany's mom, who had Iman and Tiffany's two younger children with her. But Tiffany herself was nowhere to be found. Her mom told him that she had showed up in the middle of the night, dropped her two kids off, changed her clothes, and then left. She said Tiffany told her that she had to leave because she didn't want to go to jail. Tiffany's mom then showed him the clothing she had left behind. He immediately called for the crime scene investigators to respond. While the search for Tiffany began, Iman was in custody, talking to police. At first, he told them that Imani had died after ingesting a household cleaner, but then he told them that Tiffany had poisoned her, saying that his wife and his daughter had a, quote, rocky relationship. But after being questioned further, Iman finally said, "I'm guilty. I killed my baby." Tiffany ended up turning herself in later that Saturday afternoon. Both she and Iman were charged in connection with Imani's death, charges that included felony murder, first-degree child cruelty, and concealing a death. An autopsy showed that Imani hadn't eaten for at least several days, and according to the arrest warrants, Tiffany and Iman had kept her from doing so. She weighed just 32 pounds at the time of her death. A memorial service was held for Imani, and more than 200 people from the community showed up to pay their respects to the little girl that most of them had never known. And meanwhile, prosecutors announced that they would be seeking the death penalty for both Iman and Tiffany. But in June 2015, about a year and a half after his arrest, Iman changed his mind and pleaded guilty to felony murder. As part of his deal, he agreed that he would testify against Tiffany at her trial. Gwinnett County District Attorney Danny Porter told reporters that they had always believed that the driving force was Tiffany and that Iman was just a passive participant. He said Tiffany took care of her own two children that she had with Iman, but that she starved her stepdaughter. At his sentencing, Iman read a letter he had written to his now deceased daughter. Quote, "Daddy made a terrible mistake, and he is very sorry from the bottom of my heart." His attorney told the judge that Iman was not a monster, and that Tiffany had convinced him that they would lose custody of their other children if they sought medical care or tried to get help for Imani. He said Iman was guilty of gross negligence. Iman was sentenced to life in prison without parole. Tiffany's turn to face her charges didn't come until 2019, because in November of 2017, as her trial loomed ahead, she made a rather shocking decision. She told the judge in the case, Superior Court Judge George Hutchinson, that against her attorney's advice, she wanted to represent herself. She said her two attorneys, who were both public defenders, had told her that she should take a plea deal the DA's office had offered her, to plead guilty in exchange for life in prison without parole. She said she didn't want to plead guilty and that it was in her best interest to just represent herself. Tiffany's attorneys filed a motion arguing that Tiffany should not be allowed to represent herself due to, quote, neuropsychological testing data that showed the defendant to have damage to the premotor and prefrontal regions of the brain. The report they were referring to was sealed by the court. Judge Hutchinson ended up granting Tiffany's request. However, he ordered her attorneys to be standby counsel so she could ask them for help if needed. But in subsequent hearings, Judge Hutchinson became concerned that Tiffany wasn't actively taking part in her own defense. She hadn't researched her case, filed any motions, or even looked at any of the evidence that had been turned over during the discovery process. She also never submitted a list of any witnesses she planned on calling. Judge Hutchinson reportedly said to her in one hearing, quote, "They are seeking to have you executed, and I can't be more blunt than to say they are trying to have you killed. That's just as serious as it can possibly get, and I think it's best you have an attorney." He asked her to reconsider her decision, but she remained steadfast that she wanted to represent herself, calling it God's will. She said she would be representing herself in a more spiritual way than a physical way. Considering the fact that it was a capital murder case, the judge delayed the trial until Georgia's Supreme Court could review his decision to allow her to represent herself. Tiffany's attorneys had filed an appeal of his decision, but in December of 2018, the Supreme Court declined to hear the appeal, and so Tiffany would, in fact, be representing herself at trial. In his opening statements, Danny Porter, the district attorney for Gwinnett County, used the story of Cinderella as an analogy for this case, as you heard earlier. He told the jury that this might be among the most difficult decisions they've ever made in their entire lives, but that justice is sometimes difficult and the right thing to do is sometimes hard. He said the prosecution will prove that Tiffany intentionally caused the death of her stepdaughter, Imani, and that she did so during the commission of another felony, cruelty to a child. He warned that the facts of the case would be difficult to hear. He told the court that Imani's misery started 3 years prior to her death. In March of 2010, he said Tiffany, quote, beat the lights out of that child, and that teachers noticed bruises on Imani the next day and reported that to police. After a subsequent investigation, Tiffany was charged with cruelty to a child in the first degree, pleaded guilty, and was sentenced to probation. Porter said that incident changed the entire dynamic of the family going forward. Tiffany had a background in early childhood education and had been working as a pre-K teacher at the time. But after her conviction, she couldn't work anymore. So there she was at home with two young children and a six-year-old who wasn't hers. Imani was Iman's daughter from a previous relationship. Over the next few months and years, Porter said Imani tried to run away numerous times, but that each time she was returned to her family. In the summer of 2013, the family moved into an apartment in the Lawrenceville area. This was when, Porter said, for all intents and purposes, Imani vanished from the face of the earth. He said Iman was working two jobs at that time and was really just eating and sleeping at home, while Tiffany was home with their two kids and, quote, a stepdaughter that she hated. He said Imani likely died on October 30th and that Tiffany was home when she died. He said Tiffany urged Iman to get rid of the body and that she insisted that they not call the police because she didn't want to go to prison. So they planned to get rid of the body and report Imani as a runaway. But as the days went by, he said Iman started to feel like it was messed up. And finally, he couldn't take it anymore. He told Tiffany that he couldn't do it and that he was calling the police. Quote, and what did this defendant do? She took her two children, jumped into their trailblazer, and she split. And that's how police got that 3 a.m. phone call on November 2nd, he said, because Iman, who was hysterical and distraught, thought he wanted to kill himself, and he called the police.
The truth in this case is this defendant, based on the medical evidence and the evidence that we're going to put together, intentionally starved this child to death. Not by accident, not because she wouldn't eat. She refused, as she got sicker and sicker, to give her medical treatment. And then tried to dispose of the body so that they could tell the story of her runaway.
He asked the jury to find her guilty. Then it was time for Tiffany to give her opening statement.
Ms. Moss, your opening statement when you're ready, ma'am.
I'll be making an opening statement.
You will not be?
No.
All right. Mr. Porter, call your first witness.
Your Honor, of course, the defendant is also entitled to make an opening statement at the close of the state's case.
It is true.
Which you'd have to make another option.
Do you intend to make an opening statement at any point, ma'am?
No, sir.
All right. Call your first witness, sir.
That audio was a little difficult to hear, but Tiffany told the judge that she had no plans to give an opening statement at any time. The state kicked off their case by submitting Tiffany's prior indictment, plea, and sentencing in her cruelty to children in the first degree case. Judge Hutchinson asked Tiffany if she had any objections to that coming in, to which she said no. The state's first witness was Sergeant Diane King with the Gwinnett County Police Department. She told the court that in March 2010, she was a detective with the Special Victims Unit, which covered crimes against children. She said she received a referral regarding a possible cruelty case where the victim was a then 6-year-old, Imani Moss. She said school administrators at Cooper Elementary School had called the police after seeing bruises on Imani. She brought Imani into the police station so she could interview her about what had happened. She told the court that she had been trained in how to interview a child, which she then explained to the jury. She said one of the most important things to do in these interviews is not to lead the child and to ask open-ended questions, which require a yes or no answer. It's important, she said, to try not to put any ideas into their heads. Before starting the interview of a child, she said they asked questions about knowing the differences between telling the truth and lying, and they ask whether they know that lying is bad and telling the truth is good. They also ask a series of simple questions. After determining that Imani was able to differentiate between telling the truth and telling a lie, Imani then told her what had happened.
She told me she got in trouble by her stepmom, Tiffany Moss, for not doing her homework the previous night, and she was spanked with a brown leather belt.
Did she tell you how many times she'd been struck?
Several times. She had bruises and welts all over her body, to include her arms, chest, back, and legs.
All right. Did you document those injuries?
Yes, I did.
Photos of Imani's bruises were shown to the jury. Sergeant King said that Imani told her that she tried getting away from Tiffany, but couldn't. Sergeant King said she interviewed Iman, Iman's mother, Robin, and Tiffany. When she spoke with Tiffany, she said Tiffany admitted to striking Imani with a brown leather belt for not doing her homework. But she said she thought she had only struck her 3 times, which wasn't consistent with Imani's injuries. After the interviews, Sergeant King said she secured a warrant for Tiffany's arrest for cruelty to children in the first degree and arrested her. After Sergeant King wrapped up her testimony, Judge Hutchinson announced that it was time for cross-examination. "No questions, Your Honor," Tiffany said. Iman's mother, Robin Moss, then took the stand. She testified that after Imani was born, on April 23, 2003, she and Iman lived with her for a few years. She tearfully told the court that Imani would have turned 16 years old yesterday. In March 2010, after Tiffany's arrest for child cruelty, Imani came back to live with her. She said she drove Imani to and from school each day and that she was doing really well with her. In fact, she said she was thriving. But just 6 months later, Imani was placed back into the care of Iman and Tiffany. Robin said she still wanted Imani to continue living with her and that she fought the decision in court but was overruled by DFACS. After that, she said she wasn't allowed to see Imani, even though she called her son about it constantly. She said she filed multiple reports to DFACS during that time. There were only 2 occasions in which she did see Imani. Once was at a birthday party for Tiffany and Iman's young son. She said she spoke to Imani then, but that she didn't look well. The next time she saw Imani was on Mother's Day 2013, about 6 months prior to her death. She was at her daughter Sharonice's house, and Iman, Tiffany, and Imani came over. She said Imani looked very different.
She was so thin, so thin. She had this shirt on, and you can see the bones protruding out of her shoulders. And in her arms, she was so skinny, I wasn't used to that.
How was her hair?
Cut off. All of it. It's cut.
Assistant District Attorney Lisa Jones showed her a photograph of Imani from May 2013. Robin said yes, that's what she looked like, thin with short hair.
You said that you noticed her hair on Mother's Day. And why was it so different to you?
Because Imani had long hair and it shouldn't have been cut.
Did you ask about how her hairstyle came to be like that?
Yes, I did. I said, why is her hair cut off?
And who did you ask that to?
I asked Tiffany that.
And what was the response?
If you act ugly, you should look ugly.
She told the jury that she never saw Imani after that. She didn't know where they were living or how to reach them. She said Iman called her once and said he would bring Imani by, but he never did. Once Robin's testimony was completed, Judge Hutchinson asked Tiffany if she had any questions for cross-examination. No questions, Your Honor, Tiffany replied. Tyler Hill, a road officer for the Gwinnett County Police Department, testified next. He said that on July 2, 2012, he responded to a runaway call at an apartment complex in Lawrenceville. Someone from the leasing office called 911 and told them that they had a runaway in their office. It was Imani Moss. When he arrived, Imani told him her name, her age, and where she lived in the complex. She also told him why she wanted to run away.
Did she explain to you why she was going to run away?
She did. She said about a week prior, her stepmother tied her to a chair utilizing belts and put her under a cold shower.
As you observed her, were you able to see any injuries or welts on her arms or anywhere on her body?
I did ask her to see her arms. As she started to lift them to show me, she became hesitant and then put them back down by her side. Her statement to me was that the belts did not hurt, so there weren't any marks.
Okay. What did you do next?
I then asked her to look at her arms a little closer. She had a reddened area, and she explained that she had burnt herself cooking there. My next step was to go and speak with the stepmother at the time.
And did you identify the stepmother?
I did. We left another officer at the leasing office with the victim, and then I went to the apartment. And I collected her identification at that time.
And who did you identify her as?
On her driver's license, it was listed as Tiffany Moss.
He said Tiffany told him that Imani was just resentful because she had married Imani's father and that they had one child with another on the way. She denied having abused Imani. She told him that after her arrest in 2010, Iman was the one who handled the punishment duties. Officer Hill said he had no corroborating evidence, and so he couldn't do anything. He created a report that alerted the Special Victims Unit, and he also referred it to DFACS. After District Attorney Porter was finished with his questioning, he said, "Mrs. Moss might have some questions for you." "No questions, Your Honor," Tiffany replied. John Kirshner, another Gwinnett County officer, testified that he was dispatched to a call at the same complex a few weeks later, on July 25th, 2012. The nature of that call was also a runaway juvenile. Officer Kirshner said Iman Moss had called 911 and told them that his 9-year-old daughter was missing. He said she had left around 9:30 that night. Officer Kirshner arrived at the scene a little after 11 p.m. and spoke with Iman and Tiffany. Tiffany told him that at about 9:30, Imani was in the kitchen doing dishes when suddenly she heard the door slam from the other room. She realized Imani was no longer in the apartment. She told Officer Kirshner that she had checked the surrounding area in the complex but couldn't find her. She said Imani had run away 4 times in the last month. About an hour and a half after the call came through, Officer Kirshner said a passerby found Imani sleeping in the bushes in the front of the apartment complex next door. He tried questioning her, but Imani wouldn't really talk to him. She said she couldn't tell him why she ran away, but said she didn't want to go back because she didn't want to get into trouble. Officer Kirshner told the court that he ended up charging Imani with runaway and curfew violations. He said he did that so she could appear in front of a judge and talk to the judge, since she wouldn't talk to him.
Is it a fairly common practice to
take out a juvenile complaint form on runaways if you're trying to get them some help in the juvenile system?
Yeah, that's very common.
Right. And have you done it in other cases?
Yes.
Now, in that case, was Imani taken into custody or was she released to her parents?
She was released back to her parents.
So the juvenile referral that you made would essentially be a ticket and release or just set a court date and they would have to show up.
Yeah, it's just a juvenile complaint form which gets forwarded to the juvenile department. And I believe Iman Moss signed a release that we released him back into his custody.
All right. Are you aware if that case ever went to juvenile court or whether you ever testified in it?
I'm not. I don't recall.
But you never testified in it?
I did not.
He said he didn't notice anything unusual about Imani's appearance that night. When asked if she had any questions for this witness, Tiffany said, "No questions, Your Honor." Lisa Neal testified that in 2012, she was Imani's fourth grade teacher. She said she loved having Imani as a student.
What about her obedience to you? In other words, was she ever defiant or disobedient where you had to take disciplinary action?
No, she was precious. It was a blessing to have her in my classroom. She, the only issue we had was having her homework completed on a regular basis. She had difficulty completing her homework. The only outburst that I ever had was she cried because we had these behavior sheets that we had to write on that just to keep a record. And I was going to write down that she didn't complete her homework, and she cried and cried, and I told her it would be okay.
Those type of sheets, did those go home with the child for their parents to see?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
When you say that the only type of schoolwork that she had trouble was just getting back to school with her homework completed?
Yes.
When we talk about what happened in the classroom and her doing her work in the classroom, was she able to perform her work and her schoolwork during the day just fine?
Yes, she was.
She said Imani adored her little brother and was so proud of him that her face would light up whenever she talked about him. She said she never saw any bruises or markings on Imani, and that if she had, she absolutely would have reported it. Through tears, she recalled how Imani had the most beautiful smile, and that's what she'll always remember about her. School was her safe place, so she was always smiling at school, she said. After the school year was over, Imani never returned to the school. Lisa said she never saw her again after that. When asked about Imani's appearance during the 2012 school year, she said Imani was always little, but that she didn't have any concerns about her weight or size. Tiffany again declined to cross-examine the witness. Iman's sister and Imani's aunt, Sharonice Moss, testified that although she and her brother had a relationship, she didn't have much of one with Tiffany. She estimated that she saw Imani about 3 to 4 times a year. The last time she saw her was on Mother's Day in 2013 at her house. She described the differences she saw in her that day.
When Imani showed up there, did you notice anything different about Imani that day?
Yes, her hair was cut off and she had really beautiful long hair. And she no longer had that hair. And she seemed like she was frail and kind of timid. Her personality was different.
And you said her personality was different. What was her personality like prior to that?
Quiet. Just like a kid, just happy, you know, playful, usually. And at that time, it was more like timid and just, it was just different.
So she was at least not herself enough for you as her aunt. You noticed something about her.
Yeah, I did.
And you said that her hair, had she always worn her hair long prior to that?
Always.
Did you ask her about her hair, or did you ask anybody about why her hair was cut?
Yes, I asked her dad. I said, why did y'all cut her hair?
And was he able to give you an explanation?
He said she cut it.
And by she, you mean Imani?
Imani, yes. I'm sorry.
That's all right. Did you ask the defendant about the hairstyle at all, or only her dad?
I asked her dad, because I didn't really talk to her much about anything, really.
And when you say didn't talk to her, just so we're clear, you didn't talk to
cordial.
Tiffany much?
Yes, Tiffany was okay. More cordial, nothing.
Just pleasantries predominantly?
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
She told the court that Mother's Day was the last time she ever saw Imani. After that, she said her relationship with her brother became distant. They only talked every now and then. In August 2013, she said she was talking to Iman when he told her that Tiffany was going to start homeschooling Imani. She said that made no sense to her, and she felt like something wasn't right with that. So she called DFACS and made a report.
And why did you call DFACS with regard to that?
Because I was concerned.
Why were you concerned, Sharonice?
Because she was not going to school, and it just seemed like something was wrong. Something wasn't right. I don't know. Because I wasn't talking to them every day. I didn't live by them. I didn't see them. But it was just something in my spirit just told me something wasn't right. And then when the last time I saw her, when she really just didn't seem like herself, and then her not going to school, that was a red flag for me. Because I don't see how any mother could do that, knowing that they got two small kids. I know I couldn't do it.
Tiffany again declined to cross-examine the witness. Pearly Bashir, Tiffany's mom, told the court that she knew about Tiffany's arrest for abusing Imani in 2010, but that she wasn't aware of all the particulars. She testified that after Iman and Tiffany regained custody of Imani, the three of them came to live with her. The other two kids weren't born yet. She said they also came to live with her again in the summer of 2013, this time with their other kids too. She said Imani was thin, but that she was eating then, and she didn't have any concerns about her. Later that summer, she said Tiffany and her family moved out into another apartment in Lawrenceville, the apartment where they lived until Imani died. She said she would sometimes go over to the apartment to drop stuff off, but wouldn't really go inside. On October 27th, 2013, just days before Imani died, she, Tiffany, and her other daughter, Brittany, went out for Brittany's birthday. She said she never saw Imani that night. Then, in the early morning hours of November 2nd, Tiffany came over in the middle of the night, knocking on the door and ringing the doorbell. Pearly said she was groggy from having been asleep, but she got up, went downstairs, and opened the door to see Tiffany and her two kids standing there. Tiffany asked her what took her so long, and then she brought the children inside. She then went back to her car to get the car seat and some other clothes she had packed. Pearly said Tiffany told her, "Don't let them take my children." Tiffany then told her that Imani was dead. Pearly told the jury that it's all a blur, trying to remember everything that was said. She recalled that Tiffany then couldn't find her car keys. She had misplaced them while bringing the kids and their belongings inside, and so she said she needed Brittany to take her somewhere. So Pearly said she went upstairs and woke Brittany up. Tiffany didn't stay long. After Brittany woke up, they both left in Brittany's car. Pearly said she doesn't know where they went. She was asked to describe Tiffany's demeanor that night.
She was stressed. Upset. She was just stressed. She was in upset.
Pearly told the court that shortly after Tiffany and Brittany left, the police arrived. When Pearly was finished with her testimony, Judge Hutchinson asked Tiffany if she wanted to cross-examine her mother. "No questions, Your Honor," Tiffany said. Tiffany's sister Brittany then took the stand. She told the court that in 2013, she had just returned home from college and was living with her mother. She said when Tiffany, Iman, Imani, and their other two kids came to stay with them, Imani seemed normal, although she would typically only see her in passing because she would work long hours. After Tiffany and her family moved out and into their own apartment, Brittany said she would usually stop by there sometimes late at night after she got off work. She said the kids were usually already in bed at that time. She recalled how Tiffany would talk to her about the difficulties with being a new stepmom, and she said she remembers Tiffany mentioning that Imani wouldn't want to eat sometimes, but that she did. Brittany told the court that when she, her mom, and Tiffany went out for her birthday on October 27th, Tiffany was acting normally. Nothing seemed out of the ordinary. Then, later that week, on Halloween, she spoke with Tiffany. She said Tiffany sent her a photo of the two younger kids in their costumes. In the early morning hours of November 2nd, she said she was sleeping and remembers Tiffany coming into her room and telling her that she needed help. She said she was confused and that Tiffany said, "They're coming." She said she didn't understand what that meant. She was half asleep. But she got up and told Tiffany to get in her car and tell her where she should take her. She told the court that she doesn't remember where exactly they went. She just followed Tiffany's directions to an apartment complex. She said she didn't know whose apartment it was. When they pulled up, Tiffany got out and gave her directions on how to get back. She said during their car ride, she and Tiffany had no further discussions about what was going on. She said she asked Tiffany, but that Tiffany just told her she needed help. At that time, she said she had no idea that Imani was dead. Once she got back to her mom's house, the police were there. They didn't explain what was going on at first. They just said they were looking for Tiffany. She said she didn't tell them where she had taken her until she learned that Imani was dead. The prosecution admitted into evidence photos of the three ladies from Brittany's birthday. "Any objection?" Judge Hutchinson asked Tiffany. "No objection," Tiffany replied. She also declined to cross-examine her sister. After an entire day of near silence from the defense table, District Attorney Porter asked to be put on the record about Tiffany's lack of questioning the witnesses.
Yes, Your Honor, I think there's a matter that needs to be put on the record in light of the events yesterday. As it's obvious to the court and that the defendant did not question a single witness nor give an opening statement, I think it's important at this stage that we place on the record that the defendant does in fact have a notepad. She appears to be taking notes, although I of course have not seen them. She appears to be attentive and paying attention to the testimony. She also has had complete access to standby counsel. I personally have observed them go back with her. I, of course, have no idea what consultations are taking place. The only thing I think that would be useful on the record at this point is to confirm with the defendant that she has access to her discovery materials should she want them. I think they've been brought over here at the court's request and that she has access to them.
Judge Hutchinson agreed and said Tiffany seemed to be actively engaged and involved in what was going on. He asked if she has everything she needs and if she has access to everything that is required. "I do have access, Your Honor," she responded. The judge asked her if there's anything else she needs or anything he can help her with, and she said, "No, Your Honor." One of Tiffany's standby attorneys then stood up and addressed the court, stating that they don't believe that she's participating.
Given what Mr. Porter has just said, we actually prepared a motion that I'm going to file to address this issue. We do not believe that she is participating for the reasons we stated before as it relates to why we believe she shouldn't have been allowed to represent herself. So we spelled it out in the motion. I'm going to file it, and I'll bring the copies up for the court to address at some point in time. Her files are still in the locked room. I think she's not accessed those files in over a year. So they're here, but they haven't been accessed. And so since we're placing that on the record, we think the record should fully reflect what has happened.
After their on-the-record remarks, testimony continued. A man named Terrell Bethay testified that he lived next door to the Moss family. He said he only saw Imani once, in October 2013, but that he would see Tiffany, Iman, and the two younger kids more often. He was asked if he had ever heard anything coming from the Moss's apartment, and he said yes. He said he would hear running and screams every now and then, but nothing that ever caused him to go knock on their door. Tiffany declined to ask him any questions. Iman Moss, the state's star witness, would testify next. And what he would tell the jury would be nothing short of chilling. Imagine if your phone was the same as it was in the 1940s. Well, that is exactly when the technology you are using to clean your air was developed, with the invention of the HEPA filter. Thankfully, Molecule has introduced a breakthrough science that is finally capable of destroying air pollutants at a molecular level. Molecule's PICO technology goes beyond HEPA filtration. It captures and completely destroys the full spectrum of indoor air pollutants, including those 1,000 times smaller than what a HEPA filter can catch. In fact, in a study of 49 allergy sufferers presented at the American College of Asthma, Allergy, and Immunology, Molecule's technology provided dramatic, statistically significant symptom reduction within a week of use. One customer even said that she was able to breathe through her nose for the first time in 15 years. And Molecule doesn't just have groundbreaking technology on the inside. It creates a complete and clean air purification experience from the materials used on the device, like its sleek, solid aluminum shell, to a streamlined filter subscription, with replacement filters arriving at your doorstep right when you need them. Molecule's technology has been personally effective and verified by science, but most importantly, it's been tested by real people. Molecule has already helped allergy and asthma sufferers around the country better cope with their conditions and significantly reduce their symptoms. For $75 off your first order, visit molecule.com. That's M-O-L-E-K-U-L-E.com and enter the code JUNKIE at checkout. Molecule, the air you were meant to breathe, is finally here. There are over 64 skincare mistakes most of us are making, and some of them could seriously be harming your skin. Things you're probably not even thinking about, like using ingredients that make your skin more vulnerable to dark spots, or using the wrong anti-aging ingredients that can cause more aging, or not layering products correctly. With Beauty by Design, you never have to make another skincare mistake again. Beauty by Design gives you a completely personalized skincare routine and connects you with a live esthetician that you can text for free for life. Your esthetician creates a regimen personalized for your needs with options at different price points. Just answer a few questions about your skin and send a selfie. Then you'll have a short consultation with your esthetician and get a detailed diagnosis and personalized recommendations. Only order the products you need when you need them. Shipping and returns are always free. I recently started using Beauty by Design, and they really helped me choose a skincare regimen that works for me based on my skin and my habits. I was essentially just washing my face and using a moisturizer, and one that happened to be making my skin far too oily. When I spoke to my Beauty by Design esthetician, I walked her through the skincare products I was using, and I told her that I was looking for a more complete skincare routine, especially now that I'm 37. She recommended some items that would help. I chose which ones I wanted, and days later, they were at my doorstep. I've been using those products for about a week now. They're buffing cleanser, repairing moisturizer, brightening serum, and eye treatment, and I couldn't be more impressed. I'm already noticing a difference. I'll show you the items I got on my Instagram stories, at CourtJunkie on Instagram, so be on the lookout for that. And I have a really good promo code for you Court Junkies. Go to beautybydesign.com/junkie and use the promo code JUNKIE. First-time customers get 20% off. That's promo code JUNKIE at beautybydesign.com/junkie for 20% off. When Amon Moss testified, he wore a green prison-issued jumpsuit, his feet shackled at his ankles. His handcuffs came off at the start of his testimony, only for the duration of his time on the witness stand. Amon told the jury that he pleaded guilty in August 2015 to his role in Imani's death, and that he's been serving his sentence ever since. He said he and Imani's mom were involved in a relationship back when Imani was born, in April 2003. When asked where Imani's mom is now, he said he honestly doesn't know. He said he's had sole custody of her for years and that Imani had no contact with her birth mother. In 2007, he met Tiffany at a church through a friend. He said Tiffany never seemed to have any problems or concerns about him having a child from a previous relationship, and they started dating. 2 years later, their relationship turned serious and they got married and moved in together. He said things were good in their house at the time. He had a job working at a warehousing company and Tiffany was a pre-K school teacher. But then, in 2010, everything changed. He said he was at work when he got a phone call from a detective telling him that there was an emergency involving his daughter, Imani. He went to the police station, and that's when he found out that Tiffany had been accused of beating Imani. After Tiffany's arrest, he said things got rough. Tiffany wasn't allowed to teach anymore, and so she never worked again. Instead, she stayed home and took care of the kids while he worked. He was asked if he ever noticed any problems between Imani and Tiffany, and he said yes. He called it a love-hate relationship.
Explain to the jury what you mean by a love-hate relationship.
Her and Imani was like, it was always something. They couldn't get along. Mm-hmm.
Did you ever know of Tiffany from 2010, after 2010, to discipline Imani?
No, not until that incident.
After Tiffany's arrest, Imani was removed from their home and sent to live with her grandma, his mom. She lived there for about 6 months while Tiffany went through anger management and he went through home counseling, where he learned about other forms of discipline aside from spanking. He said after he completed that, he had several supervised visits with Imani and then got her back. He said his mom asked if Imani could remain with her, and he said no. He wanted to prove to his mom that he could do it. He told the jury that after they got Imani back, both he and Tiffany decided to not use spanking as discipline anymore. He described how he was working two jobs in 2013. He would go to the first job from 6:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. He would then usually go home to eat and change and then get to his second job by 6 p.m. He was there until about 1 in the morning. He said while he was at work, Tiffany would often text him about Imani's behavior. One time, she said that Imani had defecated and put it on the wall. Another time, she defecated and put it in her oatmeal. And then another time, she had tried to run away.
So you're her father. What did you do about that?
I didn't do absolutely nothing.
All right. Did you believe your wife when she told you that?
I did.
Why?
I don't know. I had questions, but I did.
Did you ever seek out more family counseling for your child?
I did.
Did you ever take her to a doctor to see if she was sick?
I did one time. It was in, we were staying with my mother-in-law, but I didn't stick to the appointment.
Imani recalled that at one point he got a call and text from Tiffany saying that Imani had been cooking and had spilled a pot of hot water on herself. When he got home, he said he looked at Imani and saw that she had a mark on her stomach. He was asked if he took her to the doctor then, and he said no. Imani was then asked about Mother's Day 2013 and about how his sister confronted Tiffany about Imani's hair being chopped off. He said he had known that Tiffany had cut Imani's hair, but said she never told him why. He never heard what Tiffany said to his sister that day, but later on, his sister called him and told him about it. He said she was upset. On October 24th, 2013, he got home from his second job and went to grab some food from the kitchen. He said Tiffany had told him that she had fed all the kids earlier, and so he thought they were all asleep. But Tiffany called him over from the other room and told him that there was something wrong with Imani.
Going to the bathroom, she's in the tub, and she's shaking like she's having a seizure.
So what did you do?
I didn't go with my first mind. I said we need to go take her to 911. I'll take her to the hospital.
Did Tiffany have anything to say about when you said that?
Said we can't.
He said he wanted to call 911, but Tiffany said no. So they put her on a mattress in her room. Over the next few days, he said he would go in there periodically to check on her and that he tried feeding her with the spoon, but that it wasn't working. He said she wasn't able to get up and that she had even gone to the bathroom in the bed. When asked if he called the doctor then, he said no. He said he couldn't explain it, but he felt like he was trying to fix something that was irreversible. He said what he should have done was to call 911, that when he didn't, he put himself in a bad place. But he said Tiffany told him that she didn't want to go to jail and that she was scared of losing their other kids. A few days later, Tiffany called him while he was at work and told him, "She's gone." He said he couldn't leave work early, so he left at the regular time, around 3:30. When he got home, his son was running around and playing, while his baby daughter was in the pack and play, and Tiffany was watching TV. He said he went into Imani's room and he could tell that she was dead, so he moved her body into the computer room. He told the court that he and Tiffany then talked about how to conceal the death, to make it look like she had run away.
But Iman, let me ask you, when you discovered your daughter dead, what did you want to do?
911.
And what did Tiffany want to do?
She wanted to hide it.
There's a question that has to be asked. Why did you agree to that?
I was trying to, don't make any sense. I guess out of love, I was trying to fix the problem that I couldn't fix. I was trying to save her, but I couldn't save her. I couldn't save my daughter. I can't explain.
Were you afraid of losing your other kid?
That too.
He said Tiffany came up with a plan to hide the body, that she liked to watch crime shows. She told him that they had to be on their criminal minds. For the next few days, Iman said he kept going to work, but that he would go into the computer room to see Imani and to grieve. Meanwhile, Tiffany would continue to make food for the other kids and watch TV. On October 30th, he said he went to Walmart and bought a bag of charcoal, a trash can, and a box of garbage bags. He said he bought them so they could try to cremate the body, which he admitted was his idea. The surveillance photos of Iman at the Walmart were submitted into evidence, and Tiffany did not object. The next day was Halloween. He said he got up and went to work. During the day, Tiffany sent him a picture of their two younger kids all dressed up. He said he thought they had gone trick-or-treating with Tiffany's sister. He said by this time, Tiffany was pushing him to get rid of the body, but that he kept stalling. He said he really didn't want to do it. But the next night, he and Tiffany duct taped Imani's body and put her in a trash bag in the back of their Trailblazer. They then loaded up the other kids in the car and they drove around, looking for a spot to dump the body. He said they drove through the back roads and then he told Tiffany that he was looking for a good spot, but said he was stalling because he really didn't want to do it. He described how they finally pulled over and they tried burning the body in the trash can while their other kids were sleeping in the car. But he said it didn't work, and so he put the fire out. Tiffany wanted him to bury her then, but he put her back in the trunk, and they all drove back to the apartment. He said he couldn't sleep all night, but he went to work the next day with her body still in the car.
I mean, so he parked in a parking lot with the with the body of your daughter in the back of your car?
Yes, I did. I was out of it, sir.
And when you went to work, did you finish that shift?
Yes, I did.
He said his supervisor at work pulled him aside because she could tell something was wrong with him. He said he almost told her what happened, but he didn't. When he got home from his first shift, he then got ready for his next one, the body still in his car. Tiffany was at home watching TV when he got there. He said while he was at his second job, he was really out of it, and even accidentally hit one of his coworkers with the forklift. He said he was discombobulated, grieving, and messed up. He asked his cousin Rudy to meet up with him after work. He said it was eating him at his core. Rudy got into his car with him, and he told him that Imani was dead and that she was in the back. Rudy told him to call 911 and immediately got out of the vehicle. Iman said that he then went home and told Tiffany that they had to call the police. Tiffany kept telling him no, but he insisted. So Tiffany got the kids ready, took the trash can, and left with the kids. Iman said he then called 911 and the police came. At the end of Iman's testimony, Judge Hutchinson asked if Tiffany had any questions for her husband. "No questions, Your Honor," she said. Ashley Finney, the lead crime scene specialist in the case, testified that she took photographs of where Imani's body was found, as well as the inside of the Moss's apartment. She showed the jury photos of the trash can with Imani's body inside, the trash can that they later determined had Tiffany's fingerprints on it. She said they recovered two socks, a pair of underwear, and a white shirt from the body, and that all items were badly burned and covered in stains. Finney then walked the jury through photos she took of the inside of the Moss's home, photos which included multiple food items on the shelves in the kitchen and in the refrigerator, and a box of duct tape in one of the cabinets. In Imani's bedroom was the bed with a comforter still on top of it. On the underside of the mattress were brown and yellow stains, as well as possible blood. In the family's trailblazer were items Iman said they had used to try and burn the body, including a Duraflame lighter, charcoal bag, and lighter fluid. Christopher Ford, a computer forensics examiner, testified about text messages he recovered between Iman and Tiffany in the days leading up to Imani's death. Among the text messages were several from Tiffany, who was listed as sexy wifey in Iman's phone, that complained about Imani's behavior. On October 13th, she wrote, "And your child picked at her ass, not to mention picked at her face, SMH. Then on October 14th, she wrote, "Imani boo-booed on the rug and refused to get it up, so I'll let you tell her, SMH. I'm not doing this with her today. Maybe she'll listen to you." Then on October 15th, she wrote, "I'm sorry, babe. I told you I wouldn't text or call you at work with Imani's BS. I was just frustrated. SMH. My bad, though. I hate stressing you at work. Won't happen again." Later that month, on October 28th, days after Iman said he found Imani seizuring in their bathtub, Tiffany texts that their two kids are coming down with fevers. She writes that she's giving them Tylenol, and she uses a sad face emoji. Then, on November 1st, after Imani had already passed away, Tiffany texts Iman, "My bad, babe. I was on the phone with Imani's teacher. Imani wouldn't even talk to her. SMH." Colin Flynn, the lead investigator in the case, told the jury about his interview with Iman. He said Iman had initially told him that Imani had ingested a household chemical and that they panicked and tried to hide the body. But at one point in the interview, Detective Flynn had to leave to attend Imani's autopsy, and what he learned at the autopsy didn't match up with Iman's story. When he got back to the interview room, he confronted Iman about it. He said it was very apparent that Imani had not been eating, so the tone of the interview turned to starvation. He said Iman then admitted what he knew. The medical examiner was the last witness for the state. Dr. Michelle Stauffenberg testified that Imani's cause of death was starvation and that she was, quote, "more or less skin and bones and extremely thin and emaciated." She said Imani had been deceased for at least a day or two, and she was undoubtedly a lot smaller and skinnier than most kids her age.
With regard to weight, were you able to weigh Imani Moss?
Yes.
And what was her weight?
32 pounds.
And what percentile, did you also do a comparison into a percentile for that?
Yes, according to the standard growth charts, a 10-year-old girl should weigh somewhere between 54 and 103 pounds. So this is at less than the fifth percentile.
After the state rested their case, Judge Hutchinson asked if Tiffany would be testifying, and she said no. And when he asked her to call her first witness, she replied, "No witnesses." In her closing arguments, Assistant District Attorney Lisa Jones told the jury that this case was likely different than any other case they had ever seen. But what's not different, she said, are the rules of law. She said that after Tiffany was arrested in 2010 for hitting Imani with the belt, she blamed Imani for the consequences she faced.
What started after that particular time was an utter and horrible downfall, because the relationship was effectively over at that point. Because this defendant blamed that child, blamed the six-year-old for causing her to lose her job, not be able to have her career anymore that she had gone to college for, that she wasn't able to work, and along with it came financial hardship for that family.
She said that when Imani was removed from the home and went to live with her grandma Robin, she thrived. But even though Robin fought for her, she was put back in the home with Tiffany and with her father. And it all started occurring again, Joan said. She brought up the fact that Imani had tried running away several times because, as she told one of the police officers, her stepmother was mean to her.
That child was 9 years old and would rather be in the dark, alone, sleeping in the bushes than in the room next to her. What was life like in that house when no one else was watching?
Tiffany declined to give a closing argument, which means that Tiffany had decided to represent herself, but hadn't mounted any kind of defense. She had no opening statement, no witnesses, no evidence to enter, no closing arguments. Not only that, but if you think about everything a defense team does, she chose to forego that. No cross-examining of the state's witnesses, and no objections even. District Attorney Danny Porter would later tell reporters that while the jury was deliberating, he was nervous that her strategy may actually work. He said he was fearful that she had outsmarted them, that she had come up with a brilliant legal strategy in which he and his assistant DA would look like two big bullies who had just punched her around for a week, and that one juror might sympathize with her. But the jury didn't sympathize with her. After just 3 hours of deliberations, they found her guilty of all charges. And when it came time to sentence her, they unanimously agreed on death by lethal injection. Tiffany was emotionless as the sentence was handed down. Tiffany's standby attorneys, who had argued against letting her represent herself due to a report which apparently showed that she had brain damage, called it a ridiculous spectacle and said they would be filing an appeal. "There will probably be lawyers from all over the country that want to help us with this," one of them said. But Porter said he wasn't convinced that Tiffany did in fact have any brain damage, saying that they've seen no evidence of that. Tiffany is currently the only woman on death row in Georgia. In June 2018, Imani's grandmother, Robin Moss, filed a lawsuit against the Department of Family and Children's Services, or DFACS as they were referred to at trial. According to the lawsuit, after Tiffany's arrest in 2010, there were numerous additional incidents, aside from the ones discussed at Tiffany's trial, that had been reported to DFACS. For example, in May 2012, employees at Imani's school reported that Imani was suffering from emotional and psychological neglect. They said Tiffany had hit Imani on her back and head with a belt because she was eating breakfast too slowly and was about to miss the bus. The school nurse gave her an ice pack at school. Although DFACS investigated the incident, they concluded that Imani's injuries were, quote, insignificant and determined to be corporal punishment. Then, in August 2013, just 2 months before her death, someone made an anonymous phone call to DFACS, saying that Imani was being neglected and that she was looking too thin. But according to the lawsuit, there was never any follow-up, and the claim was dismissed due to, quote, having no current address and no current maltreatment. The lawsuit alleges that had caseworkers stepped in sooner, Imani's life could have been saved. There was a part in Imani's fourth grade teacher's testimony that I wanted to share with you as I close out this episode. It seems like it helps paint a picture of who Imani Moss was.
During your time then, did she participate in your class?
Yes, yeah. She completed all her projects and she was a wonderful friend, to every student, even a bully, that she tried so hard to be friends with on a daily basis. One time she wrote a letter to me and to the bully and said, let's just be friends, let's forget about what happened. And she said, Miss Neal, I'm sorry for the meanness that this child and I had, and you know, we'll be nice to one another. And she just was a precious girl.
And that's all for today's episode. I'd love to know what you think about this case. What are your thoughts on the actions or inactions of DFACS? What do you think should be done to prevent something like this in the future? And regarding Tiffany representing herself and then not mounting a defense, what are your theories on why she did that? And did you agree with the verdict and sentencing? Let me know by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com, tweeting me at courtjunkiepod, or finding me on Instagram and answering the polls that I've been putting up after each episode. You can find me there at Court Junkie, and the polls are in my story highlights. And I want to give a special thank you to Eric, one of my listeners who helped me get the trial audio for this episode. As always, if you want to listen to these episodes early and ad-free, please consider going to courtjunkie.com/support and donating as little as $1 a month. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.